For example, Paul's sister, comma, who is an attorney in New York City, comma, paid him a surprise visit. Here, Paul has just one sister, and we're mentioning that she lives in New York City. But let's imagine that Paul has more than one sister, and we're specifying which sister it is. No commas. Paul's sister, who is an attorney in New York City, paid him a surprise visit. In some ways, the third rule for commas is very similar to the second. So third, we should have commas around any kind of parenthetical phrase. For example, the U.S. Constitution, comma, as discussed earlier, comma, outlines. As discussed earlier is a parenthetical. The fourth time that we're told to use a comma, we should use commas after introductory subordinate clauses. Here's an example. After the mayor met with citizens from the neighborhood, comma, she approved a zoning change that would allow a high-rise hotel. There's some debate about whether a comma should or shouldn't separate a subordinate clause like that if it comes after the main clause. So let's take that sentence and rearrange it. The mayor approved a zoning change that would allow a high-rise hotel after the mayor met with citizens from the neighborhood. Should you have a comma before the after the mayor? People debate it. I would probably say no. I tend to be a bit more of a minimalist when it comes to commas, but some people like the comma there. The fifth time that commas are recommended for us. We should have commas in a list between items. For example, nouns, comma, verbs, comma, and adverbs. Or nouns, comma, verbs, no comma, and adverbs. As you can tell, what I've just said raises the question of the Oxford comma. This is the comma, sometimes called the serial comma, after the penultimate item in a list. It's called the Oxford comma because Oxford University Press has been following this rule to put a comma after the penultimate item since 1893. It's in some ways a holdover from the heavy punctuation of the 18th and 19th centuries. With attempts to streamline or minimize punctuation in the 20th century, the Oxford comma was taken out in some style guides, but not all. Now, in terms of whether or not you would use an Oxford comma, it's typically a question of house style or personal style. One of the things that I've noticed is that people can have strikingly strong feelings about the Oxford comma, myself included. I really like the Oxford comma, and I tend to use the Oxford comma. Now, some people argue that the Oxford comma should be required because otherwise there can be ambiguity in the sentence. And there is a funny cartoon that's been circulating on the internet to capture the problem or the potential problem with leaving out the comma. This cartoon starts with a drawing of JFK, Stalin, and two female strippers with the sentence, "We invited the strippers, comma, JFK, comma, and Stalin." Then beneath that, it has a picture with JFK and Stalin dressed as strippers with the sentence, "We invited the strippers, comma, JFK and Stalin." It's clever. And yes, the Oxford comma helps here to disambiguate whether you have four people or whether you only have two and somehow JFK and Stalin have become strippers. But I have to say, you actually have to work quite hard to create a list where it is ambiguous based on whether or not the Oxford comma is there. Think about the list I started with, nouns, verbs, and adverbs. There's no ambiguity. It doesn't matter whether I use the Oxford comma or not. Now, my own view on this, you know that I like the Oxford comma and I tend to use it. As an editor, if there is no house style, I just tend to insist on consistency. If you're going to use the Oxford comma, always use the Oxford comma. If you're not going to use the Oxford comma, then don't use it. I do realize that sometimes I can put perhaps too high a priority on consistency. I'm not sure that all readers would notice if sometimes there was an Oxford comma and sometimes there wasn't. But some of you might be the kind of reader who would notice, and I don't want to distract you. So let's either always use the Oxford comma or always not use it. The question of consistency comes up with constructions where the comma is variable, like whether or not you can use an Oxford comma. And this can come up particularly with introductory adverbials. It often depends on how long that introductory adverbial is. Let me show you what I mean. Let's imagine the sentence, "Suddenly the peace treaty seemed untenable." Would you put a comma after "suddenly"? Most people probably wouldn't. It's just a one-word adverb or adverbial. You could also have something like, "In addition, the data were hand-checked for accuracy." Would you put a comma after "in addition"? There you're going to see a lot of variation. Some people would and would say, "I'm trying to capture the pause, in addition." Some people would not. Then, most people would put a comma if the adverbial starts to get longer than that. For example, "In addition to higher pay for all employees, comma," because now we don't just have "in addition," we've got "in addition to higher pay for all employees," and we separate that out from whatever's coming next. As we've already talked about, the adverbial "however" has its own rules for how we need to deal with commas. If it's coming in the middle of a clause, it will get commas on both sides. If it's coming at the beginning of a clause, it will get a comma right after it. Part of each of our decisions about commas is going to depend on whether we prefer lightly or more heavily punctuated text. There are the aesthetics of the page to consider. I'm having an ongoing discussion with one of my colleagues about whether in email it would be "Hi, Eileen," with no comma, or "Hi, comma, Eileen." I argue for the no comma because "Hi, Eileen," for me, is a greeting similar to "Dear Eileen." But she argues for "Hi, comma, Eileen," because that's what you would do if you were writing dialogue in, say, a short story. In the end, it's really about aesthetics, not correctness on that one. But for all this, there is one thing a comma cannot do. It cannot connect two clauses without a coordinator, at least according to most style guides for formal English. When a comma does this, when it connects two clauses with no coordinator, this is what we call a comma splice. It's called a comma splice because we're using splice in the sense of to fuse together. We're splicing those two clauses together, and the comma is trying to splice them together all by itself. The comma can do many things, but we say it can't do that. It needs a coordinator. Now, it was possible to use comma splices in formal edited standard prose before the 20th century, but now we're told we're not allowed to use comma splices unless, of course, you're licensed to do it because of your stature as a writer. This is one of those, you're allowed to break the rule if you know it and if other people think you know the rule. Now, speaking of aesthetics, many people have strong feelings about the semicolon. There are those who think the semicolon should never be used. For example, Kurt Vonnegut, George Orwell. The semicolon has been called ugly, odious, girly, useless. But then the semicolon has some big fans. Ben Jonson was a fan, as was Charles Dickens. David Crystal, the linguist, also quite likes the semicolon. People sometimes call it nuanced and sophisticated. The 18th century witnessed the explosion of the semicolon. Lindley Murray described it as the punctuation mark that divided a compound sentence into two or more parts. And here's the way he described it. Not so closely connected as those which are separated by a comma, nor yet so little depend on each other as those which are distinguished by a colon. And you can still find some quite heavy use of semicolons in the first half of the 20th century. You'll often see cited Evelyn Waugh's 1945 novel, Brideshead Revisited, for its, well, let's just call it heavy use of semicolons, including these lines. "I have been here before," I said, semicolon. "I had been there before," semicolon. "First with Sebastian more than 20 years ago on a cloudless day in June, when the ditches were white with fool's parsley and meadow sweet, and the air heavy with all the scents of summer," semicolon. "It was a day of peculiar splendor, such as our climate affords once or twice a year, when leaf and flower and bird and sunlit stone and shadow seem all to proclaim the glory of God," semicolon. "And though I had been there so often, in so many moods, it was to that first visit that my heart returned on this, my latest." Now that's a lot of semicolons. At this point, semicolons have two main uses. The first is that they join two independent clauses that have a close semantic relationship. There could be no conjunctive adverb along with the semicolon, or there could be a conjunctive adverb like nevertheless or thus or put differently. That semicolon is trying to show us as readers that the ideas in those two independent clauses are tightly linked, more tightly linked than they are if we put a period in between. At one point, one of my students described the semicolon as a California stop. A period is a real stop sign. A semicolon is when you're at a stop sign and you do that rolling stop as you go into the next clause. The second time we're told to use a semicolon is in a list where the items are long, and perhaps where those items in the list already have punctuation within them. Here's an example. "I went to Vegas with my friend Auden, who had never been to Vegas," semicolon, "my sister, who loves Vegas in a way I don't understand," semicolon, "and my mother, who just wanted to spend time with us." So you can see the semicolon is usefully separating out the items in that list. And those are the main uses of the semicolon, whether you're a fan of the semicolon or not. The colon, when it was introduced at the end of the 16th century, was used to mark a pause that was longer than a comma or a semicolon, but shorter than a period. As I said, punctuation when it first came in was about how to read a text aloud. I love the description of the colon as somehow urging us as a reader forward, that it's foreshadowing what is to come. One of the things the colon can do is tell us that what's coming is going to explain what we've already read, or it's going to exemplify what we've already read. We now typically use the colon before lists, before examples, before definitions or other kinds of explanatory material. The colon and the semicolon barely figure in the written English of texting. Their formality, I think, makes them a bad choice, both rhetorically and aesthetically, for those who are frequent texters. But they do serve an important role in the smiley and winky face. And now the dash. Can one misuse the dash? I think the answer has to be yes, but it's hard to do. Now, what one can definitely do is overuse the dash. And I have to say, I see this as an editor as well as a teacher, that I will read a paragraph that has, say, four dashes in it because people just start using it instead of semicolons or colons, and that can get distracting. Now, the dash can serve the same function as a comma, a semicolon, or a colon, but sometimes with a different, less formal connotation. The dash may suggest that this is an interruption or a new thought or perhaps an afterthought. The dash can also set off an explanation. Here's a nice example from an article in the Journal of Human Communication Research that was published in 2016. Two experiments examined the effects of processing fluency, dash, that is, the ease with which speech is processed, dash, on language attitudes toward native and foreign accented speech. So you see there that the dash is separating out the explanation of a term. But sometimes no other punctuation mark will quite do the trick. You actually need a dash. For example, let's imagine you have an introductory list and that's followed by a clause. You'll often see a dash there, especially if that list is long, that you have a long, you have X, Y, and Z, and X, Y, and Z are all sort of long items. And then you get a dash and say, all these help explain blah, blah, blah. A dash can also help you add a phrase, not a clause, that wouldn't do well with a comma. Here's an example from George Eliot's Middlemarch. He had done nothing exceptional in marrying, dash, nothing but what society sanctions and considers an occasion for wreaths and bouquets. That dash there, I think, does better than a comma. As we think about punctuation in formal writing, I think we do well to remember Bishop Louth in the 18th century, who wrote, "The doctrine of punctuation must needs be very imperfect. Few precise rules can be given, which will hold without exception in all cases. But much must be left to the judgment and taste of the writer." I think that's great advice. There are guidelines, but the very creativity of human language and of good prose will require some flexibility and some application of good sense to punctuation. And then we need to recognize that punctuation will differ in different registers. There is a sense out there that in texting, no one knows how to use punctuation, or perhaps that texting is ruining our sense of punctuation. And I want to finish this lecture by talking about what I think is happening in terms of punctuation and texting. This idea that texting is the wild west of punctuation and young people don't care about how punctuation works, that idea, I think, is not true. In my experience working with undergraduates, what's actually happening is that the rules of punctuation in texting are different from the rules we follow in formal edited prose. In texting, punctuation needs to do something different, and there are rules. One of the things that I do in class sometimes is I ask each student to bring in 10 rules of texting etiquette, at least 5 of which need to involve punctuation. As a class, we compile those rules into a shared etiquette guide for texting. And what all of us are struck by is how much shared knowledge there is about how to use punctuation when you're texting and what different punctuation marks mean. Think about early punctuation, which was used to capture oral delivery. Now in texting, punctuation is being used to capture tone, to capture facial expression and other parts of context. This is one of the real problems with texting, is that we're having a conversation, often in almost real time. These texts are going back and forth very quickly, but we're often missing the context that we would have in spoken conversation. I can't see whether you're smiling. I don't know if you're laughing. And as we know, without that context, texting can go really wrong. For this reason, texters are adapting punctuation and other elements of text to try to help capture tone, facial expression, and the like. So emoticons and emoji help do some of this work. That smiley face says, "I'm just joking right now," or "I'm smiling." The emoji where you can have the "laughing so hard, I'm crying" is a way to capture context. Also, these abbreviations like JK for "just kidding," "ha ha" to show I'm laughing, or LOL, which started meaning laughing out loud, it's now weakened, and often now undergraduates tell me that they will put it at the end of a text, much like just kidding. It's a way to say, I'm not being serious about whatever I just said. Some punctuation marks have then been repurposed to help capture tone. And I like that verb, repurposed, because it suggests that there is nothing chaotic about what's happening with punctuation on texting. An exclamation mark is to show agreement, but not necessarily lots of enthusiasm, unless there are several. So yes, exclamation mark, is just a happy yes. The period has become serious, if not a little bit angry. The ellipsis is skeptical, or perhaps it invites a response. If I put an ellipsis at the end, it's a way to do some turn-taking on text and say, now it's your turn to text. The unmarked generic punctuation in texting at this point is no punctuation. Let me show you what I mean with a few different texts around okay. Let's imagine one text that is okay, no punctuation. Then let's imagine one that is okay, period. And one that is okay, dot, dot, dot. And my students tell me it's dot, 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 not ellipsis. Are those three okays feeling all the same to you? When I show those three okays to a room of undergraduates, they say, oh, those are completely different. The first okay, no punctuation, is neutral, like okay. The okay with a period, that one is angry. That's okay, but I'm not happy about it. And the okay dot 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 is very skeptical. In tone, that would be something like, okay, but I'm not happy. And they tell me that if you absolutely want to end a relationship, you just write K, single letter, period. That's it. Students tell me stories about passing around a phone to edit a message before sending it out to decide should that be two exclamation marks or three. Or passing around a phone when a text comes in to decide what that punctuation means in the text they just received. What I'm trying to say here is that this is not chaos, and young people who are on text a lot do care about punctuation. They're just using punctuation in a different way. Punctuation can do lots of different things in different registers. I think it's important for us to remember that its function is to help us create meaningful, less ambiguous prose in writing. Let's keep that in mind as we think about our attachment to any one rule we've learned about punctuation. Punctuation can and will adapt to our needs in different contexts, and right now, one of those contexts is texting. Speaking of punctuation on the move, let me transition to the next lecture, which is about apostrophes. This punctuation mark just won't sit still. And yet, we can be quite judgmental of people when they get those apostrophes wrong.
Lecture 23. It's confusing.
I think there is an idea out there that there was a moment in the history of the English language, say the mid-19th century or so, but everyone has a different date in mind. There was this moment when English speakers and writers all agreed on how to use an apostrophe. And then it's been all downhill since then. I'm here to tell you that from what I can tell as a historian of the English language, there has never been such a moment. The apostrophe is perhaps the most unstable punctuation mark in English, and it has long been unstable. Yet, we will sometimes judge others severely based on how they use the apostrophe. Joking at grocery stores, at grocers' apostrophes like apples, apostrophe S. Or deciding not to go on a date with someone because their online profile misuses its, no apostrophe versus its with an apostrophe. I'm not going to say that I don't notice apostrophes that are missing or have gone astray from standard conventions, but I work hard to keep any conclusions I might draw in check. I know, if I'm honest about it, how many times I've caught a wrong its with an apostrophe in an email before I sent it. I have to think about, is it master's degree no apostrophe or master's degree apostrophe S? And when I learned more about the rules for apostrophes, I realized how idiosyncratic some of them are, as we'll talk about in this lecture. For example, the Moses Jesus exception? I'm being serious. Stay tuned. The word apostrophe is a French borrowing coming into English in the 16th century. Etymologically, it comes from the Greek for turning away or an elision. The apostrophe has historically been used for contractions. There you see that elision meaning. For example, the older contraction ont, O-N apostrophe T for on it, as well as refused, R-E-F-U-S apostrophe D, which was used to indicate that that would be only two syllables instead of refused, which was one of the possible pronunciations. So the apostrophe started being used for contractions, and then, perhaps because it was just so useful, it expanded to start to be used for possessives, and this was in earlier eras, both possessives of nouns and possessives of pronouns. So you'll find hers, H-E-R apostrophe S, theirs, T-H-E-I-R apostrophe S, and its, I-T apostrophe S. Yes, that is a historical form. The apostrophe was also expanded to include plurals. Yes, plurals. Historically, the apostrophe has been used that way in English. The apostrophe was then reined in as part of the standardization of punctuation. At this point, the apostrophe is used for possessives of nouns as well as contractions, and then a few plurals still, just to make things confusing, and we'll talk more about that. It is this double use of the apostrophe for the possessive and for contractions that makes its, with and without an apostrophe, tricky, as we'll discuss. Let's start with contractions. Contractions are largely straightforward. What happens is we take two words and we smush them together, smush being the technical term for this process, and then letters or sounds get left out. The apostrophe represents those letters or sounds that have been omitted. So cannot becomes can't, do not becomes don't, I am becomes I'm, you are becomes your, it is becomes it. Fine. We can also use the apostrophe to show that we've left off a letter or a sound at the beginning or the end of a word. We see this in something like till, apostrophe T-I-L, if people want to show that they've shortened until. We also see that to capture the pronunciation runnin' instead of running, R-U-N-N-I-N, apostrophe. Now, as a linguist, I do have to note that we often think that that apostrophe in runnin' is to capture the fact that we've dropped the G. If you listen to runnin' and running, you will hear that almost all English speakers have dropped the G. It's the difference between the sound n, run in, and ing, running. But we use the apostrophe in run in to capture that difference in pronunciation. As I said, the use of apostrophes for contractions or omitted sounds and letters is pretty straightforward. Possessives in English are now marked with a final S, both in the singular and the plural. And the only thing that distinguishes the singular from the plural is where the apostrophe goes. In the singular, the apostrophe was put in there to represent the omission of the E from the historical possessive final ES. that E got lost and the apostrophe was put in to represent that loss. So here we're seeing that S is an old inflectional ending that has come down. We lost the vowel, but we kept the S. The S apostrophe for the plural did not settle down until the 19th century. Now, I know this is basic, but as long as we're here, let's just do this as part of the review in terms of how singulars make the possessive. You take the noun, you add an apostrophe S. So cat becomes cats, apostrophe S. My mother, my mothers, apostrophe S. The moon, the moons, apostrophe S. It, its, apostrophe S. No. No, we don't get to do that with it. It is understandable that we want to extend this pattern with the singular noun and apostrophe S to pronouns. And that's part of why I was playing right there by putting all those nouns with apostrophe S and then just putting the it at the end to show how understandable it is that we want to do that. But pronouns work differently. In the first person singular, we don't actually get an S at all to make the possessive. We have I as the nominative form, and then my or mine for the determiner or the standalone pronoun. No S. With all the others, we see a change of form, and then we get the S for the pronoun. For example, you have you, and then you have your or yours, the determiner and the standalone pronoun. So you change the form, add the S. We becomes our or ours. They, their, or theirs. He, his, and because it already ends in S, it has the same form as the determiner or the pronoun, and then she becomes her or hers. We don't see any confusion here about whether there should be an apostrophe because the pronoun is changing form as it becomes a possessive. The pronoun it is the only personal pronoun that stays the same in the possessive and just adds S to create its no apostrophe. So it is no wonder that speakers are more inclined to want to use an apostrophe with its. It is acting more like a noun than like a pronoun in how it makes the possessive. It seems like it should be easy to remember that pronouns don't take the apostrophe to make possessive, but when you step back and think about it, it is understandable why people get mixed up on its versus its. So before you judge and it's gone wrong, I would encourage you just to pause and consider what judgment you're about to make. I get emails from brilliant people from across the university who sometimes mix up their apostrophes, people for whom proofing emails, or at least proofing emails at that moment, was not at the top of their priority list. And I realize that I may have sent a few mixed up its if I wasn't proofing carefully that day. Now let's deal with the nouns where the possessive gets tricky. Nouns that end with S. Do you add another S and have an apostrophe S, or do you just put an apostrophe at the end of the word, given that it already has a final S? This one gets me every time, and my aesthetics about it seem to change over time. For example, in one book that I published, I was writing about Lynn Truss, and I was writing about Lynn Truss's book, Eats, Shoots, and Leaves. In the first pass, I had Trusses, T-R-U-S-S, apostrophe S. And then, when I was going over the page proofs, I decided I didn't like the way that looked, and I went to Truss, T-R-U-S-S, apostrophe. And then, after I sent off the proofs, I had some moment of panic, and I emailed the editor and said, no, no, please put the apostrophe S back on. Before I talk about what style guides say, let's see what your intuitions are about what looks right. Let's start with Charles's friend. Do you like Charles's friend, C-H-A-R-L-E-S, apostrophe, or Charles's friend, with a final apostrophe S at the end? I myself like the second. Let's talk about Burns and a poem by Burns. Do you like Burns's poem, B-U-R-N-S apostrophe, or Burns's poem, apostrophe S. Some part of me kind of wants the first one and maybe to pronounce it Burns Palm, but the part of me that likes consistency goes for the second and says, if I'm going to have Charles's apostrophe S, I'm going to have Burns's apostrophe S. You'll notice that as I said those, I was running into a pronunciation issue as to whether the final S in the possessive is pronounced. Is it Burns Palm or Burns's Palm? In other phrases, it's clear that the S would always be pronounced, but with Burns, one could argue it either way. Here's one where the S would always be pronounced, and again, let's see where you want that apostrophe. We're talking about a memo that was written by the boss. It's the boss's memo. Is that boss, B-O-S-S, apostrophe, or is that bosses, B-O-S-S, apostrophe S? To me, that's clearly the second, because you the pronunciation of the extra syllable, and I want apostrophe S. Some style guides say to let pronunciation guide your choice. If there is an added syllable, add another S and the apostrophe to represent the new syllable. If not, just add an apostrophe. But other style guides, including Strunk and White, advise that we should always make the possessive of singular nouns by adding apostrophe S. Always, except for a selection of ancient proper names ending in a final US, ES, or IS. Strunk and White cite Jesus, Moses, and Isis, the goddess, as exceptions. So it's always Moses, M-O-S-E-S, apostrophe, even if you say Moses is, and Jesus, J-E-S-U-S, apostrophe. Or you can take the escape hatch here and go with something like the laws of Moses. Other guides only mention Moses and Jesus as the exception, but not always other ancient figures. Brian Garner in Modern American Usage, in the end, also defers to tradition on this one, making an exception, in other words, the places where you just use a final apostrophe, for classical names like Jesus and Aristophanes, and names of companies and countries like General Motors and the United States. I would guess many of you will like the look of company names and the United States better if they are exceptions to the rule and only take an apostrophe. Let's start with General Motors. And we're talking about the reputation of General Motors. It's General Motors' reputation. And there are two choices here. That could be Motors, M-O-T-O-R-S, apostrophe, or General Motors, M-O-T-O-R-S, apostrophe S. And maybe you're thinking, I wouldn't say General Motors' reputation. I would say General Motors' reputation. Just want the S apostrophe. Or, let's look at the United States and the apostrophe issue. We're talking about the next president. The United States' next president, or the United States' next president. Do you want states, S apostrophe, or states, apostrophe S? I would guess many of you want states with just an apostrophe. Now, we often get out of the possessive issue with the United States because we can use the United States as a noun modifier. In other words, we can just put the United States before the noun that it's modifying and not use a possessive there. So, for example, you can get something like the U.S. economy or the United States economy with no apostrophe, or the U.S. military. Or we can rephrase with an of construction and say the next president of the United States, and then we don't have to worry about the apostrophe at all. Then there are these funny cases where a word ends with the sound S, but the spelling doesn't end in S. Our rule about always adding S to a singular noun, if you follow that rule, means that nouns ending in, for example, X and pronounced with S get a final S. Let's talk about Karl Marx. Now, Karl Marx had ideas, which means we might want to talk about Marx's ideas, and we're told to do M-A-R-X apostrophe S, Marx's ideas. Then in English, you sometimes get French nouns that end, the spelling ends in a final S, but that is not pronounced because French doesn't pronounce that final S. So, for example, you have Descartes, and Descartes, the spelling ends in S. Now we want to talk about his philosophy. So we have Descartes' philosophy, which ends with S apostrophe S. Think about the state of Illinois, which, of course, the spelling ends with an S. We want to talk about the governor of Illinois or Illinois' governor. The pronunciation only has one S, but the spelling has Illinois ending with S apostrophe S. Where did the Moses Jesus exception come from? Style guides since the beginning of the 20th century cite tradition. Tim Green at the University of Michigan notes that the King James Version of the Bible uses Jesus with just the S apostrophe, and that was then picked up in other English Bibles. That may be the tradition that we're talking about. If you're now wondering how famous an ancient classical figure you need to be to merit the exception, that is a very fair question. Does Socrates get the exception? Ignatius of Antioch? You may get to decide. And I have to say that I assume that if Socrates is a cat, that the exception does not apply. Then we have plural nouns that end in S. This is a nightmare. Let's imagine that there is a family with the last name Jones. This family has one car, and we want to refer to that car. Is it the Joneses' car, J-O-N-E-S apostrophe, or is it the Joneses' car, J-O-N-E-S-E-S apostrophe? Most guides will say it's Joneses, the second one, J-O-N-E-S-E-S apostrophe, and they will say that if the Hastings family has a car, it's the Hastings's car. Again, put on that ES and the apostrophe. I myself much prefer taking the escape hatch here and saying the Jones family's car. Two other issues come up with the possessive. One we already talked about in the lecture on prepositions in terms of the double possessive, something like a friend of Kate's. The other is, how does the apostrophe distribute when there are two owners? Let me show you what I mean. Let's imagine two people, Kate and Dean. Together, Kate and Dean own two cars. Should we talk about Kate and Dean's cars or Kate's and Dean's cars? In other words, does the apostrophe distribute through the conjoined phrase that describes the owners, Kate and Dean? Or can you have just one apostrophe that encompasses the whole conjoined phrase, Kate and Dean? Arguably, there is a distinction in meaning depending on how you use the apostrophe. Let's imagine that Kate and Dean are a unit. They're married, they're siblings, they're roommates who share possessions. And together, they own a car. Then let's use just one apostrophe, Kate and Dean's car. That way, we can use two apostrophes to show that there are two cars which Kate and Dean own independently, Kate's and Dean's cars. In case things weren't confusing enough, now let's add to the mix that sometimes we're allowed to use the apostrophe to mark plurals. And you're thinking, no, we can't, but yes, we can. Think about these examples with numbers and letters. The 1960s. I would guess you have certainly seen the 1960s, both with just a final S and with a final apostrophe S, and perhaps you've written both of those. The apostrophe in 1960s is now more often omitted, but the New York Times still uses the apostrophe. Let's imagine something with letters. As a teacher, I say, I gave 3 A's. That could be capital A, small, lowercase s, or it could be capital A, apostrophe s. Again, there we see that apostrophe being used for plurals. But let's imagine that I'm describing the spelling of aardvark, which has 3 A's. And there I would be talking about lowercase a's, and you pretty much have to use an apostrophe in 3 A's there, because otherwise it becomes as. As a linguist, I realize that there's another place I use the apostrophe to create plurals, and that's when I'm referring to words as words, and I want to refer to multiple instances of a word. So I might say, for example, there are 4 the's in the passage, and I would have T-H-E apostrophe S. What is the future of the apostrophe? Well, of course, I actually have no idea. And I do know better than to predict the future, but let me speculate a little bit. John Richards, who's a retired copy editor and reporter in Boston, England, has founded the Apostrophe Protection Society. He's trying to make sure that the apostrophe is stabilized and remains in use. There is also the Kill the Apostrophe website, which calls the apostrophe redundant, wasteful, and snobbish. The apostrophe, at least in early texting, wasn't used that much, which could be a predictor for the demise of the apostrophe. But now that we have autocorrect, the apostrophe is back in texting. And I think that texting may not be as relevant to the future of the apostrophe. Honestly, I don't think the apostrophe will die entirely, although a couple of linguists have suggested that this might happen. But I do think that its use will probably diminish. One factor is the increasing use of noun modifiers in English, such that nouns appearing before other nouns are assumed to modify the noun afterwards, often through possession, but without a possessive S. So book's cover could also be book cover. The building steps can be the building steps. This leads to an overall reduction in the possessive marker S and the apostrophe that comes with it. Is that true only with inanimates that are possessing the book cover, the building steps? No. For example, if we're talking about students' experience, we could do students, plural, S apostrophe experience. We could also talk about the student experience, where we create a singular student and we just talk about the student experience in general with no possessive marker. Some non-standard dialects of English already do zero possession so that you don't get a final S to mark possession. To give you just one example, Beyoncé's 2016 song, Formation, got a lot of attention as an unapologetic celebration of blackness. And Beyoncé's lyrics include features of African-American English throughout, including a zero possessive like, I like my baby hair, which is a defense of her daughter wearing her hair as an afro. As we've talked about in this course, the history of English is the history of the loss of inflectional endings. And it's not surprising to see the possessive S drop out in some varieties of English. If you're thinking, we can't possibly make do without the possessive S, just remember how many inflectional endings we've lost over time, and we're doing fine. And once the noun, the possessor, is always consistently before the noun that's being possessed, that possessive S is doing some redundant work, which is how it can get lost in some varieties of English. So do we need that possessive ending? One could argue we don't need it. I know that that's a radical argument, but this is the perspective you get when you study the history of the language. So that's the loss of the S possessive ending in some circumstances in some varieties of English. Then we're seeing the loss of the apostrophe while the S remains in some street signs and the names of well-known geographical spots. The Birmingham City Council in the UK banned apostrophes from street signs in 2009. Cambridge in the UK did the same thing for any new street names in 2014. But then there was such a public uproar that they quickly reversed their decision. The United States Board on Geographic Names has a policy of removing apostrophes from titles proposed for towns, mountains, caves, and the like. Pike's Peak lost its apostrophe in 1891. Harper's Ferry also lost its apostrophe. The board allows for a few exceptions, and only a few. Martha's Vineyard got its apostrophe back in 1933. Clark's Mountain has had its apostrophe since 2002, and Ike's Point in New Jersey since 1944. People have experimented with apostrophes, especially getting rid of them, before. George Bernard Shaw used apostrophes and contractions only when there would be ambiguity without them. So he would use it in "I'll" because it could also be "ill." And he wrote, "There is not the faintest reason for persisting in the ugly and silly trick of peppering pages with these uncouth bacilli." And we probably overestimate the ambiguity that would happen without apostrophes. That, sure, if you wrote "shell" without an apostrophe, it could be "shell." But most of the time, you would know from context whether it is "shell" or "shell." For example, in context, "she'll be here at 9," it would be odd to say "shall be here at 9" if we were used to seeing "shell" written without the apostrophe. Odds are that in a lot of places, it wouldn't be ambiguous. There is concern, and I do understand it, that if we aren't careful about our apostrophes, chaos will reign in the written language. John Richards, who, as you remember, is trying to preserve the apostrophe, posed this sentence to capture the problem. "Residence refuse to be placed in bins." So there you get residence, S apostrophe, and their refuse is to be placed in bins. If you remove the apostrophe from the sign, it says, "Residents refuse to be placed in bins." Fair enough. I don't want to be placed in a bin either. It's a wonderful example of what could happen if you didn't have an apostrophe. And its ambiguity is clever. But these sentences are hard to find or hard to construct. Again, it's rare that we would get this kind of sentence without any context to know if we're talking about the residents' garbage or we're talking about stubborn residents who don't want to be put into the bins. I'm not trying to say here that we should get rid of apostrophes. I'm simply trying to keep our concern about the chaos that might ensue in check. So where are we with apostrophes? It's good to know the rules about when and where to use them and adhere to them in formal and many informal contexts, because the fact is that judgment is rampant about apostrophe use. But in terms of how we judge others, I would recommend exercising some caution. Many brilliant writers are not great proofers, and almost everyone gets mixed up at least sometimes on its. Do you really want to write someone off over an apostrophe? Now, I have one friend who says an emphatic yes to that question. She said, "I'm absolutely willing to write someone off over an apostrophe." But I do think about the fact that we still read and celebrate historical texts that use the apostrophe in very different ways and with less consistency than we insist on now in terms of where that apostrophe needs to be and where it needs not to be. And even within that consistency, as we've talked about in this lecture, there are lots of exceptions and idiosyncrasies to what is considered standard use of the apostrophe. In the last lecture of the course, and how are we already at the last lecture of the course, but here we are. In the last lecture, we'll step back and think more generally about what it can mean to have all of this grammatical knowledge at your disposal.
Lecture 24, Trending Language.
As you can probably now imagine, given what I do for a living, I regularly get emails from friends and colleagues and people I don't know with questions and concerns about what is happening in or to the English language. I love this. If I hadn't noticed this bit of grammar before, now it is squarely on my radar, which I really appreciate. If it is something that I've thought about before, the person who emails me and I can geek out about this bit of grammar we both care about together. I hope that you will feel welcome to email me about changes in usage that you are noticing too. This is how I try to stay in the know. Here's one example of an email. It was near the end of the term, and one of my colleagues at the University of Michigan sent me this email. I'm losing my mind reading papers with the expression based off of, which has become very widely used rather than based on. What do you know about where it came from? Now, at the time I got the email, I knew very little about based off of, although I had noticed it in student writing, and you may have noticed it in writing too. I went to go learn more about this construction. How new is based off of? Where does it come from? Is it ever used in formal writing? And why or why not? You now know where I went to learn more about based off of. I went to online databases, of course. First, I went to Google Books and GramViewer and searched for based off of. I discovered that it has risen dramatically since 1980, including tripling in use between 2000 and 2008. And the reason I have to stop at 2008 is because Google Books, the searchable database, only goes up to 2008 at the time of this taping. Now, before you decide that the tide has turned on based off of and it suddenly, because it's had this dramatic rise, is standard use, search based on. Based on outnumbers based off of 10,000 to 1 in 2008. Now, it's not surprising that we're seeing based off of in student writing. Students, if you're teaching undergraduates, are at the age where they are the movers and shakers of language change, as we've talked about before in this course. And based off of is a fairly colloquial feature that they may be bringing into use and may not realize is colloquial and know to edit it out of their academic prose. Change in grammar typically happens first in the spoken language, which can make it feel less formal, and that's why we may notice it when it first finds its way into writing. Why might speakers be shifting to based off of? There's no definite answer here, but here are a couple of factors. As we've talked about before in this course, prepositions are notoriously idiomatic. You just have to learn them, and they don't always make sense. Why is it as a result and not in a result or for a result? It is, after all, in conclusion and for a reason. And then sometimes the idiom just shifts, and we need to use a new preposition. Second, while based on makes sense as we build on the base of something that's already there, we can also build off things if you think about that. When we extend them, we build off them. And we do have jumping off points. So one could argue that there is a logic to based off of in addition to based on. Some folks don't like off of in based off of because they think it is redundant, which is, I have to say, a completely fair point. Interestingly, off of is not a new redundancy. As we've seen many times in this course before, something we notice and we think, oh, that's new, or not. It's been around for a while. Now, being old doesn't make a construction inherently good, but it does suggest that this is a redundancy that doesn't grate on all that many speakers, at least too much in the general scheme of things. Here's an example of off of from Shakespeare's Henry VI, Part 2. And it's Simcox when he's asked why he is lame. And he responds, a fall off of a tree. Now, off of tends to be colloquial, but it will sometimes appear in more formal writing. I went